The headlines: Russia slams European signatories to the JCPOA for their unconstructive approach and opposes any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the accord. Rights groups call for accountability after U.S. decision not to punish forces involved in a drone strike that killed Afghan children. And also, the World Health Organization warns Omicron is spreading at an unprecedented rate, urging countries to raise their shields. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Moscow says the stances of the European parties to the 2015 deal with Iran in the ongoing Vienna talks are surprising, unconstructive, and somewhat illogical, as if they were sitting at a negotiating table for the first time. Russia's representative to the Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, has made the remarks in an interview with Iran's Russian-language Pars Today. He believes that the Vienna talks are moving ahead slowly with high chances of having a positive outcome. The Russian representative said the Iranian delegation is very serious with clear demands. He also praised Iran's draft proposals as a step forward. Ulyanov said Moscow is opposed to any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. According to Ulyanov, there are major obstacles to getting a guarantee from the U.S. that it won't withdraw from the deal again. Journalist and political analyst Abbas Aslani is joining us now from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Mr. Aslani, let's jump right in. What do you think about the recent comments coming from Russia's envoy to the talks?
Well, it seems the excessive demands by the Europeans as well as the United States in Vienna talks are in a way that even the other parties in the 4+1 are protesting against those demands. The problem, Western parties in the negotiations are just seeing the deal in terms of their own concerns, and they disregard the Iranian concerns when it comes to the benefiting from the lifting of the sanctions. And if that is the case, I think there will be no success in the talks. There needs to be a balance in the demands or the approaches in the negotiations. And the Europeans, as well as the United States, want to put the pressure of time, as well as, the IAEA-related issues on Iranian delegation in order to get more compromises, meaning that they want to give less to Iran but to gain more from the country. And this will not be a balance that can contribute to the restoration of the JCPOA, as well as that will also be detrimental to the durability of the 2015 nuclear agreement.
How much of Europe's stance do you think is coming from or is being steered by the United States?
Well, so far we have not seen a constructive approach from the American side as well as the European ones. And at times we've seen that the demands by Europeans sometimes have been even more radical and harsher than the Americans. But these two seem to be playing together as the actors who are hand in hand, and they have not been flexible when it comes to the sanctions related issues, but they have been focusing on their demands when it comes to the nuclear issues, and this cannot result in a solution in the end, and they have to change the approach. So far we have not seen that, let's say, change that is needed in the negotiations, but what will happen in future, we have to see and wait what's going to happen.
All right, thanks a lot, Abbas Aslani, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Tehran. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman tells Press TV that the discussions with the International Atomic Energy Agency have made progress. Said Khatibzadeh says talks between head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, and IAEA chief Rafael Grossi have narrowed gaps over several issues of mutual interest. Khatibzadeh says the two sides are expected to reach an understanding soon. The IAEA has been asking for access to a nuclear site that came under a sabotage attack in June. That's the centrifuge compound manufacturing workshop at the Tesa-Karaj complex. Iran says it will give the agency access to the site only if all the other parties to the 2015 agreement fulfill their obligations. Rights groups are slamming the U.S. decision not to punish staff involved in a botched airstrike that killed civilians in Afghanistan. The American Civil Liberties Union says it's disappointed over the outcome of the Pentagon's investigation into the late August drone strike. Aid group Nutrition and Education International says such decisions send a dangerous message that the deadly attack was justified. Advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow is calling for an international investigation, noting that the U.S. can't hold itself accountable. The Pentagon says its probe found no violation of the law. Washington has called the drone strike a tragic mistake. It says a civilian target was mistaken for a Daesh terrorist preparing to attack U.S. forces and diplomats. The strike killed 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. We've asked political commentator Sarah Flounders to comment on the issue. She says the international community must hold Washington accountable for the crimes U.S. troops committed in Afghanistan.
This is U.S. policy. Thousands and thousands of drone attacks. And again, it's been exposed as overwhelmingly attacks on civilians. And the response of the U.S. has been to jail anyone who has exposed these crimes. In Afghanistan, because by then U.S. troops were on their way out the door, they couldn't suppress the story. But it's not the first time it's come up, as Daniel Hale, who's now serving 4 years in prison, exposed thousands of drone attacks. We know that the U.S. is unaccountable, even though they directly, with a drone attack, assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian major general on a peace mission to Iraq a year ago this month. So U.S. crimes, particularly with drone warfare, continues unrelenting. There's no accountability ever in these attacks. The one in Afghanistan was just horrendous. So there should be a demand for accountability. There should be charges of war crimes for the firing of these Hellfire missiles at the press of a button. But we shouldn't expect that the United States will ever respond to these acts that they are so criminally have carried out.
Moving on, the United Arab Emirates says it will withdraw from talks to acquire billions of dollars worth of advanced U.S. weaponry. Abu Dhabi says it has made the decision due to technical requirements and sovereign operational restrictions. This means that the UAE will no longer be receiving the 50 F-35 fighter jets and nearly 20 armed drones it was hoping to acquire. Washington says it's still committed to the sales of the aircraft to the Arab country. Abu Dhabi's decision comes amid disagreements with Washington over its relationship with China. It also comes days after the United Arab Emirates struck a multi-billion dollar agreement with France for the purchase of 80 Rafale warplanes. The United Arab Emirates' reception of the Israeli Prime Minister has been met with anger. Palestinians say Abu Dhabi is betraying their cause by normalizing its relations with the regime. They're also calling for the expulsion of the UAE from the Arab League. Iran has also condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the UAE as detrimental to regional security.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel.
The UAE claims a normalization will enable it to mediate between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but that hasn't been helpful at all considering Israel's 11-day deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip in May, months after Tel Aviv normalized its ties with Abu Dhabi. Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians on an almost daily basis also raise questions about the real intentions behind the normalization.
The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ebrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as a root cause of problems in the region.
So now all of this is U.S. policy, and it's going to continue to be U.S. policy. And that's why their vassal states in the Middle East, these Arab monarchies that have no authority, really, to rule except by because of European colonialism and Western imperialism, they do what they're told.
Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
The United States hits a grim milestone in its fight against the COVID pandemic, with the number of deaths in the country now passing the 800,000 mark. The data from Johns Hopkins University represents the highest reported toll of any country in the world. Most deaths have been recorded among the unvaccinated and the elderly. The U.S. reached 50 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 two days ago. The alarming surge in deaths comes as the world is bracing for a rise in cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization warning that it's spreading at an unprecedented rate.
77 countries have now reported cases of Omicron, and the reality is that Omicron is probably in most countries, even if it hasn't been detected yet. Omicron is spreading at a rate we have not seen with any previous variant.
The WHO chief said many countries are rolling out their booster shots, warning of a repeat of vaccine hoarding and inequity. He noted that there are many people who have not received a single jab yet. Omicron was first detected in November. It has a large number of mutations. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade immunity from vaccination. Nearly 100 of Britain's Conservative lawmakers have voted against Prime Minister Boris Johnson's proposed coronavirus restrictions. Also, 17 other Tory parliamentarians abstained. The vote, revolt, means further trouble for Johnson, who is under immense pressure due to a number of scandals. Earlier this month, the Labour Party accused the Premier of taking Britain's for fools over a Christmas party held in Downing Street in breach of lockdown restrictions. The British Prime Minister also faced heavy backlash in May over the expensive refurbishment of his official residence. Well, a volcano that's been spewing lava in the Canary island of La Palma for almost 3 months finally lulls, but scientists are warning there's no room for complacency. The local Volcanology Institute says although seismic activities have stopped since Monday night, the eruption is not yet finished because it was followed by a surge in activity in previous times. The toxic fumes prompted fresh lockdowns in the island 2 days ago. La Palma's longest eruption on record has disrupted life for locals. It has destroyed almost 3,000 buildings and forced thousands of people to abandon their homes. It has also buried large areas of farmland. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand in the United Kingdom, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. We now present you an article written jointly by Robert Booth and Maya Wolf Robinson. The piece is titled, Operators Say Home Care Services Crisis in England at Worst Point Yet. Operators have warned services that look after the elderly and disabled at home are facing the worst crisis in memory, with hours of unmet care in England increasing more than fivefold since May to 1.5 million. Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. According to the Home Care Association, about half of domiciliary care providers are no longer able to take on new requests for help, and 85% of operators believe the situation is the hardest it has ever been. The charity Age UK has warned of the emergence of care deserts, a term more often applied to US healthcare shortages. The crisis threatens the welfare of some of the country's most vulnerable people and puts pressure on NHS beds, as people could be cared for in the community end up in hospital. Families told The Guardian that people feel imprisoned if carers are not available to take them outside, while their health is harmed because they forget to eat, they forget to drink or take medicine properly and on time. Jane Towson, the chief executive of Home Care Association, said, "Our strategy seems to be to neglect people in the community until they are in crisis, then blue light them into hospital." She added, "Then it is the devil's own job to get them out again because of a lack of capacity." Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, found that in the 3 months to the end of April, 286,000 hours of home care could not be delivered. By the end of October, that number stood at more than 1.5 million hours. Councils have managed to increase the number of hours delivered by 20% over that period, but it has not been close to enough. Stephen Chandler, the president of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, said, "These are not numbers, these are people's lives. Every single one is a person who is missing out on vital support that enables them to live their lives. The government must make immediate steps to ensure that everyone gets the care and support that they need this winter." Margaret McCann, an 81-year-old with dementia living alone in Brighton in East Sussex, is among those caught in the crisis. In June, she stopped eating and forgot to drink and take medication, and a crisis care team from Age UK stepped in temporarily until her family hoped a home care package from the local council could be arranged. 6 months later, the only professional care she receives is from the crisis team, which was supposed to stop after just 6 weeks. Her daughter, Sally McCann, who has a full-time job and a son aged 17 years, said, "She has dementia and lives on her own, which is a massive worry." She adds, "She is basically on her own and is losing all her social contact. It breaks my heart. The emphasis is on keeping everyone at home, but they will just deteriorate unless there is help." On a short visit recently, Margaret, who remains sprightly at times, held hands with her carer, Trevor Few, and told him, I'm nearly 82 years old, you know. He asked, what's your secret? She said, I've forgotten, adding, I tell you next time you come. Brighton and Hove City Council said it has seen a fivefold increase in demand in the last year, with families increasingly reluctant to send their loved ones into care homes. It said Brexit has hit providers' attempts to find enough staff. Sue Shanks, the chair of Council's Health and Wellbeing Board, said social care services, including home care, desperately need more government funding quickly if we are going to continue to fully meet the needs of our residents. In Salford, in the city of Manchester, Charlie Pelham, an 86-year-old who is in wheelchair after four spells in hospital this year, and Eric Griffiths, a 57-year-old who is registered deaf and blind, said they both need home care packages, but that these have either been unavailable or unsuitable, leaving them to fend for themselves. Eric Griffiths said, imagine me being blind, pushing a wheelchair. I was crashing into bus stops and tipping him out into the road because I couldn't see what I was doing. I get Charlie ready and I'm doing all the shopping by myself, doing all the cooking and the cleaning. It's really hard, but what can you do? It's got to be done. John Merry of Salford City Council said, there are challenges with the number of care workers. This is a national issue not unique to Salford. And we're working hard to bring in more service providers so there is enough resilience and capacity in care supply. In Leicestershire, Deirdre Thomas, a 68-year-old, helps look after her mother, Jean, but has been looking for evening care for 6 months. She said, my mother, Jean, is 99 years old and pretty wobbly. My heart is in my mouth. I'm so terrified she will fall over. An ambulance won't come and I will never see her again. Caroline Abrams, the charity director of Age UK, said urgent action is required to even keep the system viable, adding, for older and disabled people, the consequences of this crisis in care can be very severe. The Department of Health and Social Care said, care homes and home care providers are benefiting from hundreds of millions of pounds of investment in the social care workforce, including through a dedicated recruitment and retention fund. COVID-19 pressures are continuously kept under review, and the need for further support will be assessed as we go through the winter period.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
According to New York Times and several other news outlets, Washington has decided against punishing any members of the U.S. military involved in an August drone attack in the Afghan capital. 10 civilians, including 7 children, were killed in that attack. An internal Pentagon review has concluded that a bombing in Kabul did not violate the laws of war and was not caused by misconduct or criminal negligence. The U.S. military defended the bombing, insisting that it targeted terrorists who intended the attack U.S. soldiers.
August 30th, 2021. Grieving and baffled Afghans gather around the mangled vehicle
inside a house in Kabul. An apparent explosion a day earlier had killed 10 fellow civilians, including 7 children. The sorrow and confusion, however, would gradually give way to fury and clarity as media reports and investigations emerged over the following days. Finally, some 20 days after the incident, the U.S. decided to come out with the truth, admitting that it had made a, quote, tragic mistake in targeting the civilians. This came after initially defending their strike as righteous and insisting that it struck a Daesh vehicle carrying explosive to blow up Hamid Karzai International Airport. The strike came in the final days of the U.S.-led evacuation of Kabul after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. There was widespread condemnation of the attack, with Iran saying the U.S. cannot exonerate itself by downplaying such atrocities as mistakes. Yet, as it now turns out, this is exactly what the U.S. has done, with the Pentagon saying that there will be no disciplinary action against any U.S. troops or officials. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin had received a high-level review of the strike that made no recommendation of accountability.
None of their recommendations dealt specifically with issues of accountability. The Secretary reviewed their recommendations. I won't get into all of them. Some of them are understandably classified, but he approved their recommendations. So I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike.
This has further fueled criticism of the U.S., with the acknowledgement of the mistake standing in stunning contrast to its refusal to hold anyone accountable for any wrongdoing.
This is typical U.S. governance. There's no accountability. These are war crimes. There's no question about that. And yet the U.S., which admitted liability in this and is compensating the victim survivors, is not holding anyone accountable for this crime, the slaughter of 10 people, including several children. This is why the U.S. will not join the sign the Rome Statute and join the International Criminal Court, because it knows that it commits war crimes around the world. This one is just one of many that this crime has been committed. And the U.S. doesn't want to hold its soldiers accountable in any way, or doesn't want anyone else to hold them accountable.
Sadly, the Kabul drone strike against civilians was not a one-off incident. Just last month, a report revealed that the U.S. military had tried to cover up 2 back-to-back airstrikes against supposed Daesh targets that killed up to 64 women and children in Syria in 2019. In 2 decades of wars across the world, from Afghanistan through Iraq and Syria to Somalia, the U.S. military has killed hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. And while the military occasionally accepts responsibility for an errant airstrike or a ground raid that harms civilians, rarely does it ever hold specific individuals accountable. Maybe that trend will change one day when the U.S. itself is held accountable by the international community.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. Radio host and journalist Don DeBar joining us out of New York. And from Afghanistan Task Force of Schiller Institute, Carol Varekin, out of Paris's suburbs.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now let's go to New York. Don, this is Pentagon, and it's not acknowledging, it did not acknowledge this deadly strike until a week after there was this Times Magazine investigation and there was video evidence challenging assertions by the military that it hit a vehicle carrying explosives meant for the Kabul International Airport. I want to ask you the reason behind this reluctance and reticence, if you will, on the part of the U.S. military, usually in such occasions and incidents.
Well, they're committing war crimes and genocide against thousands of victims, potentially millions of victims, on an ongoing basis for decades. They don't want the world to have a conversation about it, and they don't want the American people to realize that that's what their money is being spent on. And so the only people that are ever punished in these cases are the whistleblowers. For example, Julian Assange. For example, Manning. For example, John Kiriakou, etc. The people who expose these incidents end up being the ones that are prosecuted, and those that are responsible for them, from the President of the United States, who authorizes them, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then to the military commanders, down to the person sitting in a closet somewhere in upstate New York who thinks they're playing a video game in terms of how much threat they're under, while people are being blown apart on the ground, including 7 children in this one of many, many incidents.
All right. Now, Carol, how do you look at this? Do you agree and share the same view with Don?
Yes, but I think the point is to look to the chain of command. Armies as such always have difficulties to recognize their errors, but there was a lot of chaos on the ground, but also in Washington itself, among different factions, among the White House and the Pentagon, and some military probably were so frustrated and they felt something and they did doing anything. So the result was both incompetent and horrendous, including that the person they was targeted, Zamari Ahmadi, which was suspected to be a terrorist, in reality was a humanitarian worker working for a U.S. charity, trying to distribute water to people which needed it. So the reputation of the U.S. military is definitely at stake here, both internationally but also at home. And if the press hadn't done their job, the affair would probably have been ignored, as many others before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, as you know, the Pentagon chief has decided not to punish any U.S. troops for this Kabul attack that killed civilians, and they just suffice to call it a tragic mistake. Is that how human lives matter to Washington?
Well, it's not a mistake, because the very presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan is a violation of international law. So any death that flows from that, whether justified under U.S. excuses or not, is an individual war crime. See, the problem is not that this one wasn't a terrorist and instead was a civilian. The United States annually, going back to at least 1945, kills more people every year than the entire collection of terrorists on the planet that year. Mm-hmm. Who's the terrorist?
Exactly, a good question. Also, there is this bad terrorist and good terrorist. Okay. Carol, the Pentagon says that the Kabul attack did not infringe on laws of war. Laws of war. What laws of war are they talking about? Killing women and children and shirking responsibility? Or is it calling peripheral damage? That's the word they use. You know, they say it's inevitable in any war.
Well, as you said before, normally... as was said before, normally there was a transition of power has been reflected on since the Doha agreements of February 2020. Mm-hmm. And some in Washington, they might have thought that this should become a bloodbath, a disaster they could then blame on somebody, on their opponents. So there was confusion on the stage, and which only was multiplying the dangers. Now, I think the only way to honestly repair this evil policy would be to immediately release the $9.5 billion of assets of the Afghan Central Bank. We don't need excuses and condolences. You know, we need a policy to rebuild this entire region by mutual win-win cooperation, not by we can put somebody in jail and we should completely drop this lunatic so-called precision drone strikes, which is completely incompetent.
All right, Don, this seems to be common practice for the U.S., I mean, the way they did it, isn't it? I mean, drones or troops kill people in the course of operations against shadow enemies like Al-Qaeda or Daesh or ISIS. Civilians are killed, not only in Afghanistan, we have the same cases in Iraq and Syria and Somalia. And the U.S. military, from time to time, they admit to errant strikes, and they rarely ever hold the perpetrators accountable. Let's have your thoughts on that.
I mean, the mode that was used in this case publicly after this particular strike was exposed, and you're going to see a prosecution probably if whoever leaked it to the Times or whoever at some point. But the mode that they used tells all. Okay, the people that are involved in the incident, normally, if you're accused of committing murder, in essence, you know, an illegal killing, a felony, under the military code of justice, you're entitled to proceeding with what's called a court member panel, which is like a jury.
Right.
Okay, there's objective fact finders instead of the decision coming down from on high. That, when they said that they would not face trial, that meant that the outcome was not going to have those hands in it. It was going to be decided by a much more powerful and smaller set. So they kicked it into an administrative proceeding, essentially, where the determination is made by the people at the top. So when they decided that that's how it was going to happen, they already decided that either one possibility was they were going to use the operator as a scapegoat instead of holding the people responsible for putting that person at the controls of those weapons which were illegally used to murder someone, and instead they were going to decide, you know, who it would be, but not them. The actual responsibility in the chain of command goes to those at the top who made the policy decisions and then gave the orders to implement them that resulted in these deaths, which occurred by military action not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, which means it is illegal under international and U.S. law, and consequently someone should be prosecuted for those murders. They decided instead that they would protect everyone involved from an actual legal proceeding that was transparent, because they conduct these things over and over, and mostly they never come to light in the media here, and consequently they are able to operate with illegal military action around the world with impunity and in the dark. That is what we are seeing one peak of when we see this particular case.
Right. And Carol, as Don is saying, I mean, you have this top military brass that Don believes that they are the people actually who decide. In this case, in the Afghan case, the top military brass decided that, well, that was a mistake. They apologized, but they're not going to punish any U.S. Military member or serviceman for whatever they did. They simply apologized for it. Okay, now, who should hold these top military brass who decide if they've done anything wrong or that was natural and it happens in any war?
Well, the final tribunal is the conscience of the world population. And what's happening with these, if you go back in history, this is completely a degeneration of military warfare, because over the last 20 years, the U.S. has privatized military operations. They want less regular army on the ground, boots on the ground. So they put in these private military corporations, which are mercenaries. So part of the drone strikes and the people operating them has been outsourced to private military companies such as Blackwater and other consorts. Now, we know since the 15th century, Machiavelli warned everybody that soldier of fortune, it's the worst thing you can do. So this is completely illegal and opposite to the U.S. Constitution. So we can have international tribunals, but we should especially mobilize the American population to clean up their own country, and because these people should be judged as traitors, including towards the U.S. Constitution, which is completely opposed to what's going on right now.
All right. John, there was also this investigation by the Times that revealed a top secret American strike cell launched tens of thousands of bombs and missiles against Daesh in Syria. But in the process, the commandos sidestepped safeguards and repeatedly killed civilians. And it's Afghanistan, this is Syria now. And again, where's accountability?
Well, start with the fact that, in fact, the U.S. war in Syria is not a U.S. war against Daesh. It's a U.S. war against Syria. And Daesh, in essence, are the ground troops coordinated with the American airstrikes and other military actions. Before the U.S. decided the Assad had to go, there was no Daesh. Daesh is a creature of the CIA and the U.S. military. And on occasion, you get some daylight into that. Like when Trump decided Daesh is the enemy, they were gone in 2 weeks. And suddenly they come back with Biden. I don't know if he drove them there or what. So if we're looking at what's going on in Syria for, you know, for some daylight on this whole thing, what's going on in Syria is U.S. impunity. They've decided they don't like the government there. They're going to change it. They've been working on that now for 10 years. There have been millions of people displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. No one is accountable for that. Again, this is a resolution that was voted down affirmatively in the United Nations Security Council several times. And until Daesh came on the scene, there was no enabling political cause for U.S. military action there. Now, military action has been conducted out in the open, more or less, for almost 10 years.
Right. And Carol, speaking of Daesh or ISIS, we also have these U.S. Drone attacks and targeted killings and extrajudicial killings, the instance of which is the Iranian top commander, General Soleimani, who was at the vanguard of the fight against Daesh in Iraq. He helped the Iraqis get rid of Daesh. And he was targeted in a U.S. attack. So we also have these extrajudicial killings. We have condemnation from U.N. rapporteurs and all that, but on the ground, not much changes, and the U.S. is still going on with these drone attacks. Everywhere in the world, they want to target whoever they want to simply take them out.
Yes, the problem is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, some people got the crazy conviction that the United States, with British backing, was the only remaining superpower in the world, and therefore it can do whatever it likes without being accountable for anything. This is the type of arrogance of power which makes it blind to reality and to its own errors, and it's a symptom of its own doom. And the best people in Russia today say, dictate to the U.S. that the U.S. should not make the same error as they did when the Soviet system collapsed, you know, which is the idea of impunity and arrogance of power.
Now, John, as you know, the U.S. does not accord recognition to the International Criminal Court, ICC, nor to the International Court of Justice, ICJ. So which world body should hold Washington accountable for its wrongs?
Well, first I'll add to that, that by the way, when they decide that some party's interest in the world could be adjusted in favor of Washington's or the people that the politicians in Washington work for, then suddenly the International Court of Justice and the ICC are, you know, valid international forum to have those things vetted. For example, the Philippines finding in the ICJ regarding South China Sea and the adverse claims in the area around Nicaragua and Colombia. You know, the United States is hot or cold depending on what the outcome is in each forum. So you have to consider that they really are playing a game of hypocrisy. But to the answer, where do you go for that? Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, we'll see how it plays out, the only people that can hold the United States government and the powers that control it, because that's really where the enemy is, are the people of the United States and in solidarity with the people of the world. And the task becomes more and more urgent to deal with this every day as the body count climbs, as the scope of the activities increase, and as the arrogance and impunity of the people that are conducting these wars in the first place finds no limit.
Mm-hmm. Carol, what do you think? If not international tribunals, So who can do what to stop this?
Well, people should escape from their video games and their Netflix addictions. You know, people should become real citizens, and it's only because we are creating real citizens in most countries in the world, and especially in the United States, that we will be able to deal with this issue. This is like a cultural war, you know, to return to a real civilization. It's not just a formal political problem. It's an entire paradigm, which is completely rotten. And if we don't change the paradigm, we will not change the outcome, or the type of events we're seeing right now.
Okay, Don, we have one more minute if you have any final comments.
I completely agree with what he just said, and if you need any evidence of that, look at your children or grandchildren, how much time they spend looking at a device that's telling them what's going on in the world instead of looking at and living in the actual material world, right. And you'll see where the problem and the solution lies.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. We had a radio host and a journalist, Don Dibar in New York, and from Afghanistan Task Force at the Schiller Institute, Carol Breakin joined us from the suburbs of Paris. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام تكلموا تعرفوا فإن المرء مخبوء تحت لسانه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Speak so that you may be known, since man is hidden under his tongue."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam.